This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Haview,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
Today, we're joined by Dan Gorman. Dan is getting his PhD in history from the University of Rochester, studying religion and culture in the 19th and 20th centuries. He is researching intellectual debates over spiritualism, the practice of talking to the dead through seances, drawing on documents at Harvard Library and the American Antiquarian Society, among other archives. Currently, Dan is an Andrew W. Mellon Digital Humanities Fellow at Rochester, a position we'll discuss today. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
For the listeners, this is a very exciting episode because on the surface, it may appear that you are not technical in the same way as some of our other guests, but one of the goals of this show is to show that many people use technology perhaps more than some might think. So in that way, I think you'll be able to teach us all something about the techniques that any modern researcher would do. Even if they're not necessarily researching technology, it's still embedded in all of your practices. At least that's what we hope to show. So thank you for joining us.
Do I need to do like one of those conflict of interest statements at the start of the show? Because I am your cousin.
Oh,
shameless nepotism brought me onto this show, John.
I hope that our many family members are also aware that Dan and I are, I believe, second cousins.
I saved a chart about this the other day. It's confusing because
your father and my mother are first cousins,
which would make you second cousins,
I think.
Yeah,
which always seems odd to me, but second
cousin. But anyway, this isn't a genealogy podcast, but I wasn't sure we should say it up front that, like, hey, you know, I didn't just get picked out of the blue to be on this show. It was John emailing me being like, want to come on my podcast?
Well, you do fit the mold of being very close to us, which I'm sure the guests all know. Our earliest guests are all close to us in one way or another. But with that being said, you add incredible diversity to the show. So why don't we get started?
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Why don't we get started with a very broad question. Dan, why don't you tell us in your own words, what is it that you do?
Well, I'm a historian, so that means I spend a lot of time thinking about dead people.
See, already we're so different from all the other episodes.
So a lot of people, you know, even when I was into college and I was getting a history degree, I mean, I wasn't originally interested in going the academic route. It's like, okay, so what do you actually do in a PhD program? What do you do if you're a historian? So essentially, for people who aren't familiar with it, if you go to grad school in history, the first chunk of it is master's coursework where, you know, you take a bunch of research seminars, you read, you know, on average, you're reading like 30 books a semester, maybe more, learning the literature, learning the big debates. You might do some research, you know, research in your field of interest.
And this is just for a little context, right? So, and we'll talk extensively about your path later, but so you graduate and then the next step, if you want to go to a certain career path, is just to get you.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Getting too in the weeds there. Anyway, basically, you do the PhD, you write your dissertation, you become an expert in a field. After that, most people traditionally with a history PhD go and teach, usually in universities and community colleges, also somewhat in private schools, just because, like, with the licensing things are a little more intricate for public schools. And oftentimes, once you have a PhD, nobody wants to, like, go back and get another master's in education. Mm-hmm. Historically, a good number of historians, social scientists would work for the government. Although the hiring freezes that have been on and off during the Trump presidency probably have affected that. I've heard at conferences presentations by people who are historians for the military, heritage commands, people working for the Forest Service, the National Archives, the Library of Congress. Other people go into book editing, design, you know, writing textbooks.
Would it be fair to say, again, just for the audience, that you are currently studying to become a professional historian? If there's a better term for it, let me know. Okay.
No, I think that's fair. And I mean, would I love to teach at a university? Yes. However, we are sitting on what I think is going to be the second Great Depression. And so beggars can't be choosers about jobs. That's why I'm trying to avail myself of resources that, you know, to have a diverse skill set, that even if I don't wind up being a professor or even as a full-time job, I can still use my historian skill set to work for a think tank or a publisher. The ability to read to synthesize large amount of information about people and to conduct interviews periodically. Because, you know, if you do more modern stuff or if you need to go to an archive and you need to access these documents that like have been in a vault for 50 years, you need to know how to talk to people.
So what would a day in your life look like as a current active PhD student?
Pre-pandemic or after?
I think after we should talk about, but start with pre, right? Say just did okay.
So like I was saying earlier when I got a little too bogged down. So the first chunk of the PhD is like you're earning a master's degree, right? You learn the literature, you do some research and all that stuff. John, this will be familiar to you as you just came out of your PhD program. Then you take some really big and scary exams that hopefully are the last tests you'll ever take. Once you pass those, you shift into writing what's called your dissertation. Other people call it a thesis. For historians and people in like English political science, it's usually about a 250-page double-spaced document on a single topic. Now, I know that's different from John's thesis because he got to write basically a collection of 5 papers on similar topics and call it a day. No. I've got to write a sustained thing on one topic, and I'm enjoying that for the most part. So a normal day for me would be treat it like kind of like a 9-to-5 job. Get up, maybe go to the gym, get dressed, go to school, go to whatever I'm using as a workspace, work for a couple hours, break for lunch, work for another couple hours, maybe go to the gym if I'm lazy that day. And I didn't do it in the morning. And then, go home, have dinner, study a little bit, repeat.
And when you say work for a couple hours, you mean just reading and writing and yes. More reading and writing?
Well, and it varies too, right? Like if it's a semester where I'm teaching, then you're in the classroom with the professor, meeting with students one-on-one, grading papers, which is always... Well, actually, I actually really like that because I like writing. But, if you have a stack of 50 exams that need to be graded by like the next day, it's not the most fun feeling in the world.
Is it a requirement for someone, for a PhD student to teach in?
It usually is a requirement. Yeah. It's part of the process.
Okay.
And also like, you earning your salary, so to speak, from the university.
Yeah. And it was the same thing for physics too, because it partially is right. That you can generate value for yourself for the school,
but cheap labor.
But also, as you pointed out, very often when you get a PhD, the common career path is for you to teach. So naturally,
but that's not the only career path.
Yeah. So teaching is kind of embedded into the curriculum in that way. And it's not always formal. Like I know at Tulane, where I went to grad school, I'm trying to recall, you weren't required to teach certainly your entire time. But you were expected to.
At some point, yes. I've done, I've taught my own class. I've been a teaching assistant. I have to teach at least one more class of my own before I graduate. Now, this is where the path starts to diverge and where the technical people theme starts to come in. Now, remember earlier I was talking about how historians don't have to teach, even though that's what they're most commonly associated with. There are other paths, however, like working for the government or one of these, like the Brookings Institution, these Washington think tanks that put out white papers. So depending where you're working, you may need other skill sets, and anymore that increasingly involves mastering digital technology of one sort or another. At my university, because they're also recognizing that there aren't as many teaching jobs as there used to be, at least in higher ed, some people don't want to do the teaching thing, the teaching requirements. So, but they still have to provide some service. This is where the growing field of the digital humanities come into play. Ongoing research projects that heavily integrate computer technology to study topics associated with the humanities. And the standard digital humanities lab or project is usually much more like what you'd find in the sciences, a team of people working on a single project for multiple years. Researchers come and go, but the professor or professors overseeing the project maintain that as a laboratory. So they produce graduate students, they produce undergraduate theses. And for some people who might want to teach, and maybe for some people who don't, working as a research assistant, maybe in addition to or in place of the normal teaching requirements and getting really, becoming an expert in certain digital technologies, that's how they do their university service. So that when they finish their PhD, and if they don't want to work in higher ed, or even if they do, they can say, hey, I have these extra technical skills that I can use to do XYZ things, which we can discuss the rest of this program.
And before we even do that, so you mentioned digital humanities, right, which we really want to talk about. So you're talking about that.
No one can decide if it's a singular or plural noun.
But regardless of the plurality, you're the way you're talking about it, it's as if it's a distinct, perhaps, subsection of history. In other words, not every historian works with digital technology. But like, how
do you? That's correct.
Because I think in some aspect, everyone who does research at that level uses technology. But so what's the distinction? Where does it
come
from? Okay,
so parsing some terms here. Digital history is using, you know, computer technology to further the research aims of history. Digital humanities is sort of a broader umbrella encompassing that. So that could be using computer technology to further your research in anthropology, languages, political science, philosophy, English, art history, and regular history.
But how do we define computer technology here? I mean, doesn't every single historian use, like...
Well, that's the thing. So, like, we're doing this on a computer... everybody has a computer. Hell, they even have them in elementary schools now. You know, we didn't have computers when we were in elementary school. But so there's a difference between just us doing this for daily work, whereas integrating digital technology into the actual research process. So in other words, let me give you an example. So traditionally, writing history is you go to a library or an archive, you read lots of books, you read documents produced at the time. You synthesize it, you analyze it, you write a report, whether that's a book or an essay, you know, about what you studied. And that, you know, it could be done on a typewriter or on a word processor. Now, a digital history project, for instance, let's say I was studying the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States, and I wanted to study how a particular product, let's say lumber, let's say how the train network, how that affected like lumber sales. So on the one hand, I can go to books, I can look at economic statistics about, you know, how much lumber was sold in a given year, what were the big companies. But if I want to actually visualize that and get a sense of like, okay, what are the big hubs for buying and also for producing lumber? If I can find, if I can produce data, you know, with points on a map, and if I can also then render in some way, you know, using colors or, you know, some sort of graphic device to show how much is being sent to each of these points, each of these nodes. You could have a map key off to the side explaining, okay, color blue means like, you know, thousands of tons. Color red could be tens of thousands of tons. And so then you're producing mappings, an interactive map that's visualizing this historical economic data that can then yield new conclusions that, you know, being able to actually visualize, you know, how much of a product or how many people are moving to a certain place. And then also being able to layer those over time and see how they change, that may yield different conclusions than if I had just gone to the archive, you know, summarized like the major shipments for those years. So do you see the difference where instead of just typing up the results on the computer, you're using the computer, and in this case, this hypothetical mapping technology, to actually produce your data, to take the data you have, and then to produce new data in the form of the conclusions you draw from it.
So what I'm almost hearing is you've got computer databases, you're building mathematical models and visualization techniques to help you understand what happened. Is that right?
So it's not just using a computer to write up the final results or store your notes. It's actually using the computer to process whatever your data is.
It's not so different from what physicists do in their work, where you have to gather data, you know, mathematical models where you can really dig into it and kind of... Sure, you've got this historical data and you can kind of build on it and do some optimization things and visualization to truly understand it. I think it sounds, you know, like what a lot of scientists are doing.
I'll add to that. It's sounding like the difference is, so like, for example, I was trained as a physicist. And so where did I get my data from? From physical experiments, right?
Right.
It sounds similar for you. It's just the difference of where you get your data from.
Exactly. But it's still supposed to be, I was just reading this earlier. I'm not an expert in this, right? I'm still learning a lot of this stuff. You never stop learning, but I'm doing edX has a good course on intro to digital humanities. And just today I was reading that, you know, data is supposed to be transparent, consistent. And, I forgot the last, you know, like one value per like column on the spreadsheet, you know, each box is only one thing. So whether it's the evidence you gathered from physical experiments or it's the evidence I gained from like a spreadsheet, you're supposed to, you know, you should make your data available It should be consistent, and it should be put together in a way that like someone else can make sense of it, whether that someone is like a peer reviewer or the computer that needs to crunch the numbers and make the pretty pictures.
But what do you do when the people who provided that data to you historically didn't provide all that?
Well, and that gets tricky, right? Because that's where the humanities come in and thinking about there's some people often talk about silences in the archive, you know, the holes in your data, like, okay, or how trustworthy is it, you know, bias. And this is why, again, digital humanities, it's not replacing those traditional humanities-based methods of research, the interview, the literature review, studying primary literature. It's another tool that you can bring to bear. But you still need to do all the other regular stuff you do as a historian or, again, that's my field. And I've been talking about mapping here, you know, data computation. But there are other things that digital humanities can involve. For example, if let's say I'm an English scholar or a literature scholar to pitch it more broadly, right? And I'm looking to study, you know, patterns in an author's or in a collection of author's writings. So if you can produce clean data, that is, you know, just plain text, no fancy formatting or anything, you can feed that into computer programs and using programming languages like R, you can do data analysis, corpus analysis on large volumes of text and look for patterns.
I'm not even familiar with the R language. What's that one typically used for?
I've seen that one used in geology, actually.
Yeah, it's a programming language. There's a number of people who are now using it for it's either called like text mining or corpus analysis. A corpus meaning a collection, a body of of texts. So I know one historian, Lincoln Mullen, who works at George Mason University. He's doing a project about newspapers in the 19th century. And so part of that is using, I believe, R or other programming languages to like churn through like large volumes of digitized newspapers from the 19th century and look for, you know, again, I don't remember the parameters of his project, but you see the potential for the computer to go through it much faster than a human can. Although then when the data comes out, you still have to review it. You can't assume the computer is going to do it right.
I actually think this is a really fascinating concept of basically going back in history and time to where, you know, the data hasn't necessarily changed, right? It was always there, but now we put it to a format where it could be read by a computer. But
And you have to clean it up too, because the initial scanning isn't always accurate.
But the way it's sort of clicking in my mind is it's nothing that they wouldn't have done hundreds of years ago had they had computers, but they didn't. It's a modern invention. And so now that we do have it, we need to retroactively go back, get all this data in, and then you and your associates can then actually get your trends from it. Let's go through just a couple more examples of maybe how what this has looked like in practice.
Yeah, I can speak more broadly. So basically, I'm a historian, right? So let me just explain where the digital humanities comes from. No one can, like I said, no one can really figure out if digital humanities is supposed to be singular or plural, the first digital humanities project started in 1946. A Jesuit priest named Roberto Busa, he studied the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas, you know, prolific Catholic theologian. And he got this idea. He wanted to tabulate every word that was used in Aquinas's writings and then be able to see how often they were used in what context, proximity. But this is 1946, mind you. This, we're talking about a large volume of Latin manuscripts that had been preserved through the ages and, you know, were available in like reproductions. But like this was going to take a long time. So Father Busa got the idea, what if we use computers to automate the process? This is 1946, mind you. You know, Harvard had only had the Mark I computer for the war effort like 5 years earlier, right? So his plan is to put all of every word that appears in Aquinas's writings on punch cards and then feed them through an old-time computer.
And that part was still manual, right? There's no way around that. You need
something. Yeah, no, I mean, it was talking about a huge project here. Yeah. So he goes to 1949, he went to IBM, which was, you know, it existed then, you know, International Business Machines. And he pitched it to the head of IBM, and the CEO signed off on it, you know, gave him some like basically like nonprofit gratis support. So Father Busa spent decades like making the punch cards, right? And then, of course, in the 1970s, with a plan to put them into those old analog computers where, you know, with like magnetic tape and everything, then what happens in the late 70s, early 80s?
Semiconductor?
Thank you. Yeah, the semiconductor, the computer chip is invented.
Transistor is correct, though.
It's okay. A collection of transistors, I believe.
Okay, so
you use semiconductors to make transistors. But yeah, all that, those developers came in the 50s, and then they were honed in the 60s.
Let me rephrase it then. So in the 60s and 70s, then you start to get the first personal computers, or at least the ones that weren't the size of like this apartment building. You know, computers that could fit in one room.
I think people would argue the first personal computers didn't come until what, the late 70s. But anyway.
You know, and of course, Apple's at the forefront of that. They're not the only ones, but they're the famous ones. So anyway, right. Eventually Busa takes the project and switches it from happening with punch cards to happening with, you know, electronic mainframe computers. Hmm. And I think eventually, I'm not sure. The first version I feel like came out on like some sort of floppy disk or CD. Then in the 2000s, they redid it on the internet as sort of a legacy project, just so like all the work wouldn't go adrift. Father Busa, for context, only died in 2011. Okay, so he's like, he's active in this stuff for more than 60 years.
That's impressive for an early project to be kept with one person that long.
Yeah, from 1946 to like 2006 when it goes on, or like 05. You know, like we're talking like nearly 60 years here.
And I often, just to pause, I love to marvel at people like that who have been able to see all the changes in technology going from the 1940s computers to, by 2010, I mean, they were pretty much modern.
Yeah, right? Again, you know, I don't know what state of health he was in, but like into the 2000s, like this guy was staying with it. Like,
amazing.
Well, and the other thing is also, you could talk about the influence of religion, right? This was a passion project, a labor of love. This man is a Catholic priest preserving the writings of one of the major Catholic philosophers. You know, he probably regarded this as, you know, part of his devotion to God. Obviously, he had help. He had researchers. He was working at different universities.
But to your point, that is what you're... That's what people argue is the first example of a digital humanities project.
Yes,
right?
Father Busa created it, and one of the big digital humanities groups still has the Busa Prize every year for like the big project. So just to give a couple other examples, so that was the first sort of mining large volumes of text, right, with computers to look for patterns, to look for trends. Other ones in the 1990s, because remember, computing early on, when the internet launched, even a little before that, plain text, static backgrounds, plain HTML. You know, you remember like the Space Jam website is just like one flat image, you know, you click on different things. So the mapping stuff isn't really happening yet. Initially, it's okay, we could use the internet to create archives to put online, to share pictures and to share texts. So in the late 80s, a group called the Text Encoding Initiative Consortium forms that proposes standards for how to mark up or how to format documentary editions of historically important documents. So that the TEI consortium has been running for more than 30 years now. And they've proposed, you know, they have a language and guidelines for using in XML formatting, how to format a text, you know, how to tag everything, how to compile information. And there's like this voluminous number of TEI tags for like everything from like punctuation to how to describe the publisher location, the edition of a book. All of that stuff can be marked out, you know, putting in bold, putting in notes.
This sounds like all like metadata, right? Let's say you...
Yeah, basically it's metadata and coding also how you're going to format, present, and preserve information because you want to keep all that documentary information.
Oh, okay. And just to make sure we don't lose anybody here, just to go back.
What is metadata? Metadata is data about your data.
Basically, yeah, right? When you have,
yeah, it is.
When you have a music file, right? And so the content you care about is the song, but with the file comes, for example, like the name of the artist and maybe when it was published and like the track number and all these things. So
exactly.
That's an example of metadata. So what you're saying is that this has all been standardized thanks to the work of this organization.
Yes. Now, granted, TEI, so XML is used for formatting internet websites, you know, the world over. TEI isn't really used outside of the humanities, and even it's getting kind of clunky and old-fashioned. Like, there's this kind of thing of, like, should we keep investing in this system that no one else uses to format texts? But, you know, it's still used for now, so it's still good. People in digital humanities programs, like the one I'm in, we're expected to at least have a little familiarity with it, even if we can't memorize all the tags. Like, that's what, you know, indexes are for. So the 90s saw more of these archives going up, whether in TEI or other forms. There was a project, the William Blake Archive, which it's still ongoing. I interned on it last year. That wanted to make William Blake's poetry and paintings available. So that was then figuring out how to scan and upload pictures, you know, in good quality. And then also, how do you convey, like, the material information? How do you package the metadata about the paintings? There were other archives, like collections of like the Women Writers Project, the Rossetti Archive. A lot of 19th century stuff went up there on the internet. And then by the 2000s, as computers got more sophisticated, You started to see more digital mapping, geographic information systems. So using like satellite imagery for archaeology. There are some people now using like radar, LIDAR to identify ruins and jungles, which is like 21st century Indiana Jones stuff, you know, to get the contours of old ruins underneath the trees.
I've seen documentaries of people looking for Viking settlements in Newfoundland using satellite imagery, and I guess that would be digital humanities, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it depends. That's the thing. Digital humanities is a broad tent. Or another example, using LIDAR and also multispectral imaging to preserve damaged documents. Like some of my colleagues worked on multispectral imaging, which is that you take different pictures of the same item in different wavelengths of light, and then you can use the computer to filter out different wavelengths. And if you have a damaged document, you can try to tease out the language that's underneath.
I'm actually really curious about this. And as far as like restoring ancient documents, it's
oh yeah, this is a thing.
And so this falls under the umbrella of digital
humanity, because you're recovering lost text. Now, then there are questions about, okay, how do you cite it? How do you present it on the internet? You know, but there are people, a few people at Rochester who are writing their dissertations completely or partially based on material that they have recovered. For me, my big personal interest is in the building of digital archives. So I've gotten really good at using WordPress, or at least that's what I'm learning. Tools like WordPress that allow you to build, you know, a website, but instead of doing it for a business, I'm doing it because I want to build archives. And there are other tools people want to like actually structure, ebooks online that, you can read in a particular way. But then if you want to branch off and read some of the, like go off on tangents or read things in different orders, that's an option to you as well.
So what are you putting in your archives?
Well, so a project I worked on the last 4 years was called Digitizing Rochester's Religions. It started when I was working for Professor Margarita Guillory, who taught in the religion department here, also did a lot of historical research. And then when she moved to Boston University, you know, the project couldn't really grow anymore because like the grant, she was the one who got the grant. And she said, okay, you know, you were the graduate researcher. It's your responsibility to either, you know, this project could vanish or you can actually finish up the material and present it. So I chose to do that. So in that case, the goal of the project was Western New York is a very dense religious history going back to like, you know, the colonial period and earlier. A lot of like what happened in the early 1800s up here when spiritualism, the trying to talk to dead people and seances started, Mormonism started in Rochester. So that's been written about a lot.
Mormonism started in Rochester.
Yeah, really? Well, technically, like 20 miles east of Rochester, but close in the area. Yeah. But anyway, so like the early 1800s, that's been written about a lot, right? Professor Guillory was like, you know, people kept living in Rochester. It became this industrial hub through the 1960s, and then it's now we're, you know, technically a Rust Belt city, post-industrial. You know, how did the religious diversity continue to evolve? So the idea was to use, originally we were going to use Omeka, which is this other, you know, content management system, but then I switched it to WordPress because it was simpler. Use that to scan documents that have been held onto by local religious organizations. So kind of not necessarily endangered records, but like stuff that wouldn't be, you know, aggregated in like the city archive, the municipal archives, libraries.
So are we talking about like paper documents that are in a room somewhere that you need to go like save and digitize?
Yes, and then giving copies back to those back to the organization.
And then return it to them. Say thank you. We're done. It's not.
Yeah, because you don't want to just. It's about community. It's about community centered scholarship, right? You don't want to just strip mine the data from these people. I mean, that's where you get into really bad politics of like universities. Like it's kind of that colonial model of like exploiting the people who live around them. We wanted Professor Guillory's vision, in which we tried. I think we succeeded to some extent.
And hang on, real quick. Who's Professor Guillory again?
Oh, she was my advisor. She's the best.
Okay.
But I mentioned it to be very clear. I didn't start this project. I was hired as her researcher. So she's the advisor, right? The PI, the primary investigator. I'm the research assistant, the graduate research assistant. There were several undergraduate research assistants. We worked in collaboration with librarians, people who maintain these community archives from religious organizations. And so it became a team project, much like you might see at a science lab, where the students, myself included, reviewed data, identified collections in the community, wrote essays about it. So we're putting up stories about the history of religion in Rochester and on the website. And then in addition to that, we have the archive portion with digitized source materials, making those publicly available. And it's free and open to the public.
You're taking this data from the public, but you're making it available to
the public.
So there's
it's easier to access now, right? And
right.
The organizations that gave the collections, you know, gave us written permission to use those files.
So you have access to their data, but they also now
they do as well, and then the public. So everybody has access to the data. That's the goal.
Nice.
So using that. So I'm really interested in, again, using internet technology, specifically content management systems, to then make previously overlooked historical data available to the public with both summary materials. That's where the historical analysis comes in, but then also give them the data. And then you can use that material to teach, you know, you can use it for other people to do research.
Can you just like maybe run us through, if you can, one example of say, okay, we discovered this group of documents somewhere from start to finish, you know, what's the process like where you identify the documents and then load them into your database and then you take over and do all of your work there?
Sure. So again, the project, because my advisor wound up moving to another university, we packaged the final website as a pilot project. Like we studied religion churches in a neighborhood. We eventually planned to do the whole city. So the whole city didn't happen, but like we still had that one neighborhood that was done well, right? So most of the stuff that we scanned was from one particular archive, which then, you know, you could replicate that at other places. So there's this Catholic church, St. Monica's. It's near the university campus. You know, it's an urban campus, urban neighborhood, lower economic status, multiracial, and the church has been there for decades. A number of Catholic churches in the area had closed in the 2000s because of budget cuts, so all of their archives went to St. Monica, right? So basically in a closet at St. Monica, the community archivist, John Curran, has preserved very carefully documents for all of these churches, some of which no longer existed, going back to the 1850s. So the first step, go in, assess the materials. What's there? Talk to the people who've preserved it. And also, you know, get the permission of the Monsignor, the head of the church, to like actually like you go through this stuff and look at it. So then we processed the files by which we just waded through it. We helped John organize them a bit. And then we identified things that we were interested in scanning. Now, this is where the community part comes in. It's a little bit back and forth, right? Because like there are some things that they're like, well, we don't really want you to scan that. But then we'd say, oh, but those are really interesting. You know, so we try to, you know, it's a negotiation, right? It's about building trust and being open about what you want to do and making that clear to the community. So then eventually, once we identified the stuff and we agreed on, we could borrow these files, took them to the university, put them under lock and key in another closet, and then gradually taking them out to scan them using different scanner devices. So some oversized, some fragile items, those were scanned with an overhead camera rig, professional grade. Other items were scanned on large professional grade flatbed scanners. So, you know, where you just lift the lid, put the file in, close it.
What kind of items are these? Are these documents or something else?
Documents, a lot of papers, man. So papers, photographs.
Enormous papers?
Okay, they weren't all enormous. There were a few that like big blow up prints, like from like photo exhibits. There was a chart showing like all of the pews in the church from like 1890, this one church, and then like with name keys of who sat where.
Nice. That's fun history.
So then basically in my case, I was fortunate to be at a university that had this scanning lab, right? And the staff very kindly walked me through how to use it. So, you know, for the big items, you use an overhead camera. For sort of medium items, you could put them on a plate scanner and just shut the lid. And then when it got down to like stuff from the 20th century, like tons of computer printed stuff, just take those downstairs to the basic printer in the library lobby and just scan them quickly, because those don't need to be the highest quality.
Were these documents old sufficiently? You know, I've never seen those sorts of old documents outside of a museum.
Some definitely were. I mean, some were. We had stuff going back to the 1850s.
Old sufficiently that there's like protocol for how you can handle them. You know, are these fragile pieces of
most weren't fragile. I mean, again, this is it's like labors of love, right? I mean, people had preserved these things.
Yeah,
for decades.
Pictures this kind of thing like you can't slip up and like spill a coffee on this document.
No, you can't. You can't have any liquids near them. You need to wash your hands beforehand because you don't contaminate the, you know, you can like the natural sciences, but you don't want to contaminate the sample. It's true for the historical documents. You don't want to get oils from your fingers. So try not to touch your face too much and then don't touch the documents. Often the archives have been to actually discourage the use of gloves because you lose fine motor detail, which like if you're flipping really thin pages in an old book, you need the sensory input. the gloves won't give you, but you still got to wash your hands before you go in there. Like, you know, in some ways doing archival research is like good training for COVID. Don't touch your face and wash your hands.
That's true.
Those are important life lessons.
Yeah. So then, okay. So let's say, so we scanned all these things, right? So we've got a ton of computer files and backed up on the university server. Then it's making, checking like the file types. So with the one, the plate scanner and the overhead one, those were exported as, I think the file type was called raw. It's a raw file. That's not really readable on like commercial computers. So then you've got to transition those from the raw files to JPEGs or TIFF files. TIFFs are lossless files. They're often used in the museum field, like the Gettysburg Address. If someone's got Lincoln's draft, like you can be sure there'll be a TIFF file because those files don't degrade. JPEGs will degrade every time you edit them. So like JPEGs are good because they're smaller. You can put them on a website for public consumption, but behind the scenes, you want to have that master TIFF file, you know, with that's really high definition and isn't going
to
decay.
This is good information for people to know, because this is the sort of thing where people use these files probably daily, some people, and don't necessarily know.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't. You know, if it hadn't been for, you know, the staff of the Digital Scholarship Lab explaining to me some of this stuff, and I was like, once I was in the process of it, I started thinking, okay, so I was producing new electronic files of historic documents from the 19th and 20th centuries, right? But 30 years from now, you know, historians are going to be studying what happened in the 90s and 2000s, right? So, like, you got to know about file type management. And I think that's going to become another one of the historian's tools, not replacing the normal archival analysis, incorporating theory when it's relevant. But I think being able to navigate electronic documents and file types and making them compatible, that's going to become increasingly important to the historian's toolkit.
So they're logged, right? And assuming they're on this online database. But you also spoke a lot about the opportunity that affords you to then take it and do data analysis within that database. What was your next step?
Well, so fasting forward. So then, you know, you make initial scans, you put them in the format you want. You can then make PDFs. Like, instead of having 8 files photographing each page of a pamphlet, just make one PDF and that goes on the website, you know, collecting the document together. So then,
do you then digitize the text in that or not?
So I tried with one scanner we were using with a lot of the newer stuff that had been made in like the late 20th century on typewriters and computers. I tried to run OCR scanning. Quality varies. Again, this wasn't the most sophisticated project. We were learning as we went.
Is OCR software that can...
Yes, sorry. Optical character recognition. That's what's used to make... So whenever you can copy text out of a PDF or off of a website, that's OCR text instead of just a flat picture.
I think that's really interesting technology and presumably not available for handwritten documents, right?
There are people working on it. There's a European project called Transcribus. There's, I think, a project at William & Mary. That's the holy grail, because then also that's where AI is going to become more important. I mean, I've gotten good with, or like my interest is sort of the digital storytelling and archives, you know, putting new stories on the internet and also the materials that make those stories, which then other people can use to make new arguments, right? But there are other people who are getting, some digital humanists who are like, we got to go all in and learn how to code and like get in on AI stuff. You know, the idea of if you had a computer that's smart enough that it could recognize handwriting and in different languages and different styles, you know, handwritten Cyrillic is different from handwritten Latin alphabet. So just because cracking handwriting once doesn't mean you're going to be cracking it every time. Or then what about, you know, different Chinese scripts, how Chinese characters have evolved over thousands of years. It's not going to be like a one and done. Okay, we've cracked, you know, the computer can read handwriting now.
That's true. But I'm just thinking back to, for example, the project where they were trying to identify these words that Thomas Aquinas used. I mean, how much would that aid that project, right? To just be able to scan and identify all of his work.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have needed all those punch cards, you know, or even...
Right.
But then there's questions that come into of, can you trust the data? You know, the data is, the output is only as good as the algorithm you feed it through. And then also you got to make sure your initial data is in good readable condition, that it's transparent, consistent, and clean.
Well, then you have thousands of hours of quality control. And
you know, that's where the student researchers, the grad students and the undergrads come in.
That's good for undergrads.
Well, for grad students too. Well, you know, because like grad students, you know, we get paid a salary, a small salary by our universities. And like, you know, we got to pay for groceries and stuff. So that's why some people will pick up extra hours. Other times, digital humanities projects will be integrated into courses. So it's for academic credit as opposed to salary. I've had both experiences. I've been a paid researcher and I've done it for credit. I've also done unpaid internships because, like, got to learn this stuff. or at least I want to.
And this maybe goes back to what you were saying in the beginning, but this sounds like a very valuable skill, right?
It is. But again, I don't want to give the impression that I think that every humanist needs to do that. I don't. And not everybody wants to go down this and learn. Heck, I don't even really want to learn how to code. I just want to learn how to use some of these tools that can make me a better historian. I've met people who really do want to learn how to code and know how to code. That's fine. And that's, I think that digital humanities can be a broad tent, but also it's looking at like where you are in your career and what you've had exposure to. You know, I'm 28 years old. They didn't teach coding in my high school and I wasn't a computer science major in college. Now I can learn some of that stuff on my own time, but it's going to eat up time that I still need to write my dissertation, right? So you can only learn so many extra skills after a certain point in time. Like, I want to get a real job here sooner than later.
But this is the advantage of having more of like a research group structure, where you have this group of X number of people, but more than one or two, where you can be developing this over time, which I don't know if that's standard for most, let's say, history PhD.
No, I mean, it's traditionally a solitary endeavor. You know, you do your own thing, right? You write your own dissertation. So then the question is, if you're working on a digital project, then okay, you take your little corner of data out of it and that's what your thesis is, or is this something extra you work on? Like in my case, my actual dissertation, it's not really, the digital skills I'm getting are really more professional development. They don't tie in directly to what I'm writing. That's not the case with other people. You know, I've got colleagues who actually have, you know, done text analysis, large volumes of text, who are doing, you know, mapping as part of their project. I think it's just the idea that like taking these things from other computer skill, you know, other computer subfields and saying we can use these for the humanities.
Yes.
And just, you know, broadening the skill set if you want to. Some people really don't want to do that. And, you know, they worry that digital humanities is a fad. And, you know, I don't think it's a fad, but I do see where they're coming from. Because occasionally you'll hear like university trustees or people like, oh, we can do the computer stuff. And we don't really, it's like the new humanities. Like, no. This isn't getting rid of like the old history or the language study or the art. Like, this is a tool to use to study those things. This is not a replacement.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it is really about just helping you do what you've always done.
Right.
Probably more efficiently.
Well, it depends if the things work, because like it takes a lot of time to learn these skills, the upkeep, to do the processes, to troubleshoot, to put the stuff on the internet. I mean, or back in the day to make CDs, like when we still were doing that.
Yeah, especially with all the new technology, it takes a while for any new technology to even mature to a usable state.
And you have to keep up with whatever the newest technology is. It's
constant. Yeah, exactly. If I want to stay a digital humanist, I can't just say I learned WordPress. There will be updates. The system will continue to evolve. And that's true for mapping, for audio editing, film editing, scanning. You know, also with scanning, it's not just the software. It's that the actual cameras change over time, right? Or if you are doing multispectral imaging, again, that's not what I do. But presumably the cameras have improved a lot from like what they used to do, and they will continue to improve, right? So you need to learn both the hardware and the software. So like once you're in the river, it's not like you can ever stop paddling. It's like if you want to keep going into the digital humanities, then that's another thing you need to keep studying. Just like how I'm supposed to read, like, okay, no one can read all of the new books and journal articles, but like you develop proficiency in your field and you keep with it.
Yes.
This is an extra thing then. Again, this is time away from my dissertation. And so sometimes it gets stressful. Like, okay, I got to do all this work and I want to do it, but like, what's the top priority in the given moment?
Yeah. And I kind of want to bring that back then to your story. Now there's a whole series of questions that we typically ask, but I think now'd be a good time to revisit. Can you go ahead and summarize, now that we know all this context, just give us a little snapshot for how you got to where you are? In other words,
sure.
And this is useful for people who maybe would hear this and say, hey, I'm interested in doing something like that, or just out of curiosity. So what was the path that you took that got you to here, to this specifically?
Well, like many things, it was a little bit at a time. When I was an undergrad, I actually did my undergrad at Rochester. I went somewhere else for my master's, came back for doctorate. But anyway, so Rochester take one, they were working on this project, digitizing the papers of the Post family. They were abolitionist Quakers who lived in Rochester, very not like famous historically, but they knew a lot of the famous people. They were connectors. And so it was initially like, I got a job over the summer transcribing documents. And then those transcriptions were put up on the website.
Of which year of college was this? Was this early on?
Yeah, it was like sophomore or junior year. So like 2012-ish. Okay. So that was pretty low-key digital humanities, but I was like, hey, this is cool. Like, you know, we're making the letters available of these people online, right? And then my senior year, I was involved in a class that was taking the papers of a 19th century family, the Seward family, and like making their family archive available. So that was learning some of the TEI stuff, like how to actually, like you transcribe a document, but then how to format it to make it appear the way you want on the internet. Then during my master's at Villanova, I did some volunteering at the scanning lab because at the library, because I wanted to learn more about like, you know, how scanning works and like what the workflow is. And then I took a digital history class there where we built a website about World War I using like local Pennsylvania documents about like how people participated in the war. And then when I went back to Rochester for my PhD, one of the things that drew me there was this, this fellowship they had called the Andrew W. Mellon Digital Humanities Fellowship. Mellon Foundation, which is one of the biggest grant givers for the humanities.
A lot of things.
Yeah, no, they're big. But they had given this grant to Rochester to hire, basically, it's a fellowship that you do into you're getting intensive digital humanities training and interning on projects. The money actually kind of like ran out, but then they renewed the grant. And I was like, okay, I'm going to apply for this.
At what point in your education did it become clear that you were going to need to go down to some extent this digital humanities route? Maybe even along the path to your final goal. When was that obvious to you?
Because we all have to visit archives. And well, we don't have to. Some people don't have to. But anyway, for historians, with digital cameras now, most archives have photographic policies, where as long as you're not using a flash, you can photo as much stuff as you want per their guidelines. So when you have all these pictures that you bring home with you, you got to organize it. So I think every historian has got to get at least some understanding of, if not running a database, they need to know how to organize their information and like keep straight, like, okay, image 001.jpg is from Harvard University. And then I need to know that which box it's from, which collection, which folder, right? So we're all generating tons of data all the time, all these photographs of our sources. We have to organize it and keep it straight where it's coming from, because we need to be able to replicate our data, which means if someone goes to the archive and reads the same stuff, they may not agree with my conclusion, but they'll know where I found the data. I'm still kind of trying to figure out what I'm going to work on this year, because the pandemic has like made it very difficult to be in lab settings with people for social distancing.
How has the pandemic changed your daily work?
Yeah, we never talked about that.
Yeah, well, it's you know, now that I'm done with coursework, it's primarily researching my dissertation. And again, this is where I'm glad I did take all those pictures when I was researching in Boston last summer, because I have my data with me. Also, I've been trying to get in touch now with some libraries that are reopening to see if I can pay for some scans of documents I need. But they're long lines, right? We're talking a 6-month backlog at all of these places. I've heard back from some places, and then some of the bigger archives are like, you know, you just got to wait your turn. You know, we're sorry, but like, we've got to get to all of these orders that have been piling up because the staff hasn't been on site in 6 months. This is unheard of.
And so they're scanning their documents and sending them out to researchers.
Right. And they're not always doing this for free either. So then for some people, especially for grad students, you know, I've got, you know, I have some funds I can use for this, but like, I can't like pay for like an unlimited amount of paper. And you know, this is where like the hidden like income structures of higher ed come out, right? Like if you're a fully tenured professor making six figures a year, oh yeah, I can order tons of stuff. But if you're a grad student, you know, making low five figures a year, you can't, right? So there's like these hidden like cost labor things going on. Even though, yeah, it's great, you know, libraries and archives have these digital humanities rigs. They've got the cameras, they've got the scanning equipment. But it's not free, you know, and the librarians, this is extra work that they have to do too, right? You know, and they shouldn't have to do it for free.
So does your research move over into kind of augmenting with stuff that's already available and scanned online?
To some extent. I mean, I've pared down the scope of my dissertation. I was going to cover events. My initial idea was to cover events spanning like 80 years, and I'm narrowing that. I mean, it's still going to, I'll still talk about events that happened later, but I'm not going to focus on them as much. That's going to be more like the epilogue, you know, rather than going in depth on all of like a long story. It's going to be more about the earlier stuff, which is what I'd already collected, because archival travel is still difficult.
So you're going having to go deeper into the older stuff because that's what you have available.
Right. And granted, there are still documents that like I do need even to tell that story. And so I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to access my stuff. You know, I study U.S. history. I have the advantage of all of my stuff is in this country.
Is that a disadvantage for some people?
Well, most countries right now aren't letting Americans through their borders because the pandemic is out of control here.
Oh, to be able to physically go get any documents and so forth.
Right. And then, again, if you can order stuff online, but then everywhere all over there have everybody else's lines, right? So then the problem that no one's been able to figure out is people's research came to a standstill. You know, whether because of look, 1 in 3 Americans were feeling depression because of COVID early on. Now it's we're trying to play catch up on our research, also from everything closing, reopening, but then some things are closing again. You're going to get people who aren't able to make progress on their humanities and other fields too, the sciences too. Like think of people who are going to go out and do like field work and watch animals, and now they can't travel where they need to go. You're going to have all these grad students whose research is going to be kind of stuck in limbo, you know, and depending how much data they already have, that may or may not lend itself to a full dissertation. And then is the university going to support people? Where's the money going to come from to pay these people? Because the universities are broke too. And so here, but this is an example of how you can learn all the digital humanities skills in the world. And I enjoy it. Okay, I'm not big on coding, but I like some of the other stuff. But there's these larger questions of like, how will I find a job? Can I finish my research? How well can I do my research? Or how much will I have to be like, this is the best I could do for the dissertation. I'll fix it when I write the book someday, when we can travel safely again.
And I think this is a good lead into the next question that we like to ask. And I'm especially interested because you are a historian. So I think you'll have a different perspective than a lot of people will, which is so Dan, given all you know and pertaining to either your particular field or even just in general, what are you concerned about for the future? And then we also want you to answer, what are you excited about? So maybe first for digital humanities, and then if there's anything else even outside that scope.
So for digital humanities, I am excited by, I'm excited, it's going to sound silly, but like cheaper storage costs. You can store more files for less money.
That's important to my work as well.
Although here's the hiccup. This occurred to me recently is that higher ed's getting the crap kicked out of it by the pandemic, you know, losing tuition and like everything being thrown up in the air. My concern would, you know, it's not cheap to run. Okay. So it's overall internet electronic storage is getting cheaper, but if you're running a large scale database, that's not cheap, even at, like in the aggregate over time, right? Preserving electronic files, according to the librarians I've talked to, it gets really expensive over the long term. So my concern is that because of the pandemic and universities and libraries and, you know, archives having to tighten their budgets, they may not want to invest in like large scale storage or computer infrastructure for as many projects. So you could have the paradox of like, yes, it generally speaking, it's cheaper to store stuff, or like this Apple computer I'm talking to you on can store more than my previous computer could. But what if universities are suddenly reluctant to fund new projects?
And that let me just ask this then. So you're noticing that the universities are taking a hit. I think that makes intuitive sense. Have you noticed an actual meaningful decrease in funding, or is this just a concern of what could happen given the
pandemic? It's what could happen. Again, because we're still early in this. We don't know how long it's going to go for. And we still don't know like what the final, you know, because like my salary is paid by undergraduate tuition, and we still don't know the final numbers on like how many undergrads are attending and stuff. I don't know. This is the big I don't know. I mean, what do you say to someone? I mean, my peers and I, we're all working the best we can, but you know, some people's work is more stuck than others, and so how do we pay them? Will we get paid? And if you know, if we run out of department funding, okay, because we're only guaranteed funding for a couple of years, like. You still got to keep the lights on. You got to pay for the internet you're using to get your materials, and you got to put groceries on the table and pay for healthcare because there's a pandemic. So I'm concerned basically about the larger infrastructure where digital humanities and history research is done. Now, what I'm excited about, cheaper storage, faster computers, more computing power, better, more accurate digital mapping platforms. Also, with different levels of like complexity. So like there are ones that like you can use in lower classrooms. And then there are the really advanced ones that like, you know, they're using for spy purposes at the NSA.
There's another piece of wisdom that you just reminded me of that some older folks at one of my jobs told me, which is, and these are people that I looked up to, right? These were the brilliant engineers who'd been there for 30 years and they were very good at what they did. And they came, one of them said to me, John, you have a lot more potential than I do. You'll do far more than I ever did. And I was confused by that. I said, what are you talking about? You're so accomplished. And it was just the tools that
that the three of us grew up with that are so natural to us, that will always come easier to us than it did from people who started 40 years ago who didn't have that advantage. And so,
but we're the transition. I want to push back on that just a little bit, though. We're the transition generation, right? You're a natural scientist. You spend a lot of time. I presume, do you know how to code in different languages?
Several, yeah.
Okay, so like, see, like, you really went that way. But you and I both remember, like, when we were kids and could still listen to cassette tapes and stuff. We remember the transition. I didn't go the coding road.
But listen, we're always in transition. I'm talking about we grew up on computers. When I was 7 years old, we had a personal computer. I know not
everyone did, too.
I know not everyone did, but people 40, 50 years ago, they did not.
Not have one.
No. You know, and they still need help asking us, like, how to do basic things with Microsoft Word, right? But it's just so natural to us. So that's the sort of thing they were talking about. I know not everyone taught themselves to code when they were 8. But even just basic things were part of our growing up.
That's true. But I wouldn't be surprised if the next generation, the Generation Z coming up, they're going to be even more proficient. Like the digital humanities, it's going to be a step forward from what it is now. And that's exciting.
I'm going to say the same thing to the next generation. I'm going to say to them, you have a huge advantage over me. And that's just the way it works.
To them, it's going to be obvious to use the computers in their research.
Yeah, and the thing is, it has been for some people. Like, Father Busa was, like, in his 80s or whatever when he died, you know, and he'd been doing this since the 40s.
I mean, hey, it's probably going to be pretty weird in 40 years when, like, computers are a thing of the past and the computer's just in our brain. And it just
I'm not sure how enthusiastic I am about that, you know. So there's one other thing I want to mention, because I know we're close to time. You asked me also what in history I'm excited about, so separate from digital humanities.
So yeah, aside from digital humanities or COVID or anything else, this can be open-ended. Yeah, what else are you excited about?
I am excited in history. So I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the larger cultural effects of what's happening right now. The Black Lives Matter movement exploded into public consciousness this summer in a way that it didn't even 6 years ago in Ferguson. Because you know, the media coverage, and it was just one thing too many, I think, you know, and the fact is any death of a person at the hands of authorities that shouldn't have happened, any death is too many. Right. So Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, these were the ones that just pushed everyone too far. And now we're seeing this cultural reckoning, with America's history of racism, asking tough questions that some people wanted to pretend weren't resolved. I'm excited to see what kind of historical research comes out of that, much the way how the civil rights movement of the 1960s produced research that looked, you know, that reinterpreted America's story. I'm very curious to see what's going to come down the pipeline. And this is where the digital history angle comes in. There's a lot of really cool projects being done to diversify the primary source material we have, transgender archives, other LGBT archives. I mentioned transgender archives in particular because these are stories that have traditionally been silent in the historical records. So trying to seek out and gather records, records of immigrants, of African-American communities, Latino communities, and, you know, making the interviews, film footage, photography, making all of this material from these marginalized and overlooked groups, making that available on the internet. You know, there are people working hard to give Wikipedia greater racial diversity, and international diversity, you know, because there are also to include more articles about women in history, because, like, I mentioned this to John the other day, like, there are some articles about video games that are way longer than, like, important women in world history, or they're just not, those essays haven't been written yet. So I'm excited that people are saying it's not just Black Lives Matter. It's marginalized voices matter. They matter in telling history. They matter in teaching languages. They matter in teaching public health, sociology, and it's leveraging computer technology, but also the traditional skills of the humanities, the thinking about history, causality, contingency, using those. I'm really excited with the stories that are going to be written, you know, telling a more diverse, complicated, but I think truer story of the United States.
So making American history more representative of Americans.
And people who live here who don't want to identify as Americans, you know, not all Native Americans want to identify as part of the United States. Their identity is their tribe.
So for these shifts in awareness, for example, what we're seeing now, how quick is the actual research community of history?
Some people have already been doing this, right? You know, there've been people supporting Black Lives Matter in higher ed since the movement started 7 years ago. You know, and even before that.
But I would imagine, like, for example, you know, take something in my world where, like, the Apollo moon landings accelerated research into space because it grew excitement about it, right?
Well, we are seeing some universities now, despite the hiring challenges of the pandemic, spotlighting, we want to hire people who are experts in, you know, the history of racism or different ethnic groups, immigrant groups, African-American history. So it's saying like, yes, times are tough, but we're recognizing that like these things need to be taught more because clearly as a society, we have not achieved the racial progress some people claim that we have.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really cool. And it's again, something that I'm curious how quickly like actual people on the ground, research labs are going to be able to start helping in these changes, right? To be able to do the research that's critical for our understanding.
Well, and that's where the translation part comes in, because it's one thing to do the research and share it. And then it's the next step is disseminating it, right? Through classrooms, through the textbooks that like may not be doing new research, but they're synthesizing the new research to present it to students. You know, again, there's the challenge of getting the data, analyzing it, and then you got to get it out there. And then you got to hash it out with people who don't agree with you. And this is a very fraught cultural time with certain persons who remain unnamed who don't believe there is any racism in the United States anymore, or don't see why we need to teach the history of non-white people. I won't name them, but you can take a big guess who I'm talking about.
We'll leave it to the audience to think about who that might be. And as you pointed out, we are running long on time. It's unfortunate that some of these kind of current event topics were saved for the last 10 minutes, but we're always happy to talk more in later episodes. But we always have some kind of final questions that we like to ask. One of them, James, let me know if I'm missing anything, is just quickly, for someone who would be interested in doing something like mm-hmm. you're doing, a young person, say, what advice would you give them, given what you've seen?
Yeah, getting into history and getting into the digital side of things.
So getting into history, I'd say find a topic you're already a little interested in, or if you stumble across one, something that makes you want to learn more. So something that you have a question about, then pursue that. Read more. Ask a librarian for help. Ask your friends if they're into it. Ask a teacher. That's kind of how to get into the next step, to get into the weeds. As for digital humanities or digital history, again, subset of larger digital humanities, if you want to volunteer, I know the Smithsonian often has projects where they need people to look at old documents and transcribe them, you know, free on the internet to make them available. That's kind of a low key way to get into it. For people who are in, well, high school, it depends. I mean, because also there's like FERPA things. Like if you're not legally of age, like your parents need to sign off on anything you're publishing on the internet. But, you know, there are high schools that are doing digital projects now. You know, they're simpler than what you might do in high school. But then, you know, then as long as your parent signs off on it, you know, you could publish stuff to the internet, you know, and it's like your class project. So I think look for, if you're interested in it, once you get to college, you know, look for professors who are doing this kind of stuff, right? And it doesn't all need to be the fancy, you know, oh, we're going to recover a burned text and tell what it says. Even simpler stuff, like we've got these documents, we want to make them available in a nice digital exhibit. You know, if working on something like that interests you, look around. Or even if, you know, if you're in a college town, there might be somebody at another school nearby working on it. Or since we don't have to be in the same place, if you find a cool project on the internet, you could try emailing the people.
I'll also point out a lot of people just as hobbyists are really interested in like genealogies and things like that, which we didn't even touch on. But
that's a separate.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just interesting. Just as an example to someone might say, well, how does this affect me? I know a lot of people who are into that and are trying to find some of these old documents pertaining to their own family. Again, it's a totally separate talk. But
well, yeah. But then once you get the data from the databases, how do you present it, right?
Sure.
That's another digital humanities thing that's got to get solved. So yeah. I would say, yeah, I would say start small, find something that interests you and then try to follow it. And then, you know, try to ask good questions and find people who might have good answers to those questions. And then take the information, analyze it, ask a couple other people if you want. I mean, you know, average it together and then you got to decide what you want to do.
Awesome. James, you got any questions?
I think the only question left is, the one you enjoy the most. I think we've covered it.
I know this question.
James, why don't you ask it this time? I feel like I've asked it every time.
I know what this question is.
So I want to point out that I'm the only one talking here that's not a native of New York.
Yes.
So I don't have as strong opinions, but we want to talk about your favorite pizza topping. What does pizza look like when it's done?
I'm a pizza omnivore. My father is from New York City. My mother is from Chicago. So I have an appreciation for both thin crust and deep dish. However,
that's bold.
It is bold.
The next level. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I all kinds of pizza. But toppings, I'm really fond of peppers, sweet peppers, not so much the spicy ones on pizza. I'm really big on vegetable pizzas in particular.
Like bell peppers? Like green bell pepper, that sort of thing?
Yeah, like chopped up, like green peppers, red peppers, yellow peppers, you know.
Okay.
The big bulbous ones you get at the supermarket. Not too spicy.
This is how you could tell that we're family, because I'm actually like, my answer, the correct answer, in my opinion, is just a cheese pizza, no toppings. But
well, that's the classic. But then, like, you know, but we're not in college anymore. We got to worry about our cholesterol and stuff.
Right. But that's why it's kind of a trick question in that regard. But, like, when I do put toppings on the pizza, it's the first one is typically peppers. So you could tell.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. Like, I'm also fond of, like, bacon. Well, not so much bacon, like sausage on pizza. But then there's that study a couple of years ago where they found that all processed meats are carcinogens. So not so much of that anymore, like once a year.
Oh, don't tell me that.
Yeah. We're going more in with the veggie pizzas now, I think. Or non-processed meats, you know?
Yeah. I don't need any. I'm breathing in carcinogens every day with these California fires.
Yeah. The pepperoni's not going to help, man. That's like pure salt.
Awesome. Well, yeah, as James alluded to, that's probably my favorite question. But one other thing, Dan, we just want to give you an opportunity. If people want to follow you or maybe any of the work that you do, do you want to share in any locations or links where they might be able to do that?
Sure. I mean, I maintain a LinkedIn profile, which is, you know, publicly accessible. I have a Twitter account. Trying to transition that from being a personal Twitter to being more of a professional Twitter. And as for projects, I would say if you went to the University of Rochester Digital Scholarship Lab, that would redirect to the projects. You know, there's a list there of stuff, not just that I've worked on, but that the fellows before me, other students. Yeah, and I think I've got more specific links like through my LinkedIn and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, and we'll put those relevant links in the show notes for any interested listeners so you can find out a little more. I think that's all we had.
Thanks for inviting me. This was fun.
Yeah, thanks. I learned a lot, and I think we can still be technical while talking about broader topics.
I think you can.
That's what this episode was all about. Even someone who doesn't fit into the classical, you know, STEM field, you just gave one of the most technical talks that we've had so far. So awesome.
Do some of that space archaeology stuff. That stuff's interesting.
That's space cool, archaeology. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. One word, satellites.
It's very good. And Dan, good luck finishing out.
Thank you.
Also, and maybe we'll have you. Maybe we'll have you on again sometime soon. Thank you, and thanks everyone for listening.